We want to take a few minutes to allow panelists to address questions to each other.
No. Or just respond to things we've heard.
I apologize. I didn't realize I was interrupting you. I thought you had finished, and I really didn't mean to. You
fine.
Paused unwisely. You don't pause around me. You know,
I have that trouble with my wife sometimes.
Paul, you mentioned that science begins 1 nanosecond after the Big Bang. And, of course, the Big Bang at one time was very controversial, and we also had the solid-state universe as another theory, not to mention the earlier pre-Copernican theories. My favorite story involves the lecture that Stephen Hawking gave. And when he was finished, a lady who was seated in the front row got up and she said, "Young man, it's all very well what you say, but I happen to know that the entire universe is resting on the back of a turtle." And Hawking, using his computerized speech machine, shot back a real zinger. "Ah, but what is the turtle resting on?" And she said, "You won't get me there. It's just turtles, turtles, turtles all the way down." There is a reputable scientist who has a theory about what happened before the Big Bang, although it is a singularly unhelpful theory. And this is the astrophysicist Lee Smolin of Indiana University, who in a wonderful book called Life of the Cosmos suggests that Darwinian theories apply not only to the evolution of life on Earth, but actually apply to the evolution of universes, and that new universes come into being by the process of matter collapsing into a black hole and coming out on the other side, and that given Darwinian theories, those universes which had more black hole formation would be more successful at reproducing themselves than those universes that had few or no black holes. Unfortunately for Smolin, he has only been able to find one universe to study, but he finds that it has a lot of black holes. What he has explained, if he is right, is how another universe could come into existence from ours, and perhaps how our universe came into existence from another universe. But eventually, it's just turtles, turtles, turtles all the way down, because he can't get back to that first universe, and I don't think science will ever be able to get back to that first universe. Now, if you want to step in at that point, as an 87-year-old atheist British scientist did 2 months ago when he announced that at the age of 87 he had given up atheism and started to believe in God, he said, "I believe in everything else I've ever believed in, except I now think that at the beginning there had to be somebody to set things into motion. Somebody or something or some inconceivable force, which he could call God." And I think that that's the point at which all argument ceases. We just don't know. But I think it's quite likely that even given the hypothesis that there is a God and that he was the person who set off the Big Bang, he at the same time permitted or created or allowed to happen the rules of the universe that inexorably led to us today. And everything that we think and everything that we are and all of our hopes and dreams and all of our poetry and all of our prose and all of our philosophies can be completely explained by evolutionary theory. There is not a single part of it that cannot be explained, and that's where we come to the argument for personal incredulity. You can't see how your mind could have been created by evolution, but I can see that it was. And creationists look at the universe and say, "I believe in creationism because when I look at a sunset, I see the fingerprint of God. But when I look at you, I see the fingerprint of Darwin." Because he does account for how we got to be where we're at today, and all of these so-called paradoxes have been explained away time and again. The tragedy of the, and this is my last sentence, the tragedy of the waste of time on creationist science is that every single theoretically, scientifically founded creationist theory has been refuted definitively over and over and over and over again, and you still find people who say, well, how could birds know that they needed wings in order to fly? Or how could the eye know that there was something to see? When the answer is, of course, this is a long sentence, there was a semicolon there. The answer, of course, is that life consists of making a living by not getting killed or eaten and being able to eat and kill. And the cell that can determine what is where the sun is and where the sun isn't has an advantage over a cell that cannot. And a cell that can determine what is shadow and what is sunlight, that's important if you're a plant. And a cell that can tell something that is moving from something that is not moving is like more likely to find something that is going to eat it than a cell that cannot. And so by stages like that, the invention of the eye becomes very easy, and it doesn't have to be perfect to begin with. It doesn't have to be a perfect eye. An imperfect eye is pretty good. I can hardly see without my glasses on, but I can see better than if I didn't have eyes.
You have to admit this panel's evolving, isn't it? I'm really glad that we actually did determine that there is quite a diverse view on this panel. So I really thank you for your, what I consider, wrong theories. But I really thank you for putting them out. I really do. In fear of going out on a limb, which I guess I'm not going to be that afraid to do today, you know, it's common human nature. If we can't explain something, we will invent a reason for why it happens. You know, I mean, if you go back in the history of mankind, we had a god for the sun, a god for fertility, who I still worship, by the way. A god of spring, a god of winter, a god... I mean, we've just had a god of the sea. I mean, let's remember all this. But I think today we have evolved, and we do look at science as something that plays a very important aspect in our history, not just in education. Science affects political policy, people. Science affects, and there's tons of debates here going on with stem cell research, with you know, our healthcare. You know, political policy pushed science to create the bomb. So therefore, we should really care what is real science and what is really not science. And we should really try to divide that fine line. And you know, if someday our panelists here are correct and there's scientific evolution, I will be the first to admit I was wrong. And that let's bring over their theories, well, their beliefs, into our science classes. I don't think today we are anywhere near that. And outside of having great armchair conversations in the salon and talking about hypotheticals, we're not at a point where we can say, hey, this is science. This is the way it works. We have millions of dollars that I've spoken about earlier that are being funneled to scientists trying to establish some kind of credibility for this. It's not there yet. And this, what we teach in our schools, in our science classes, directly will affect our standard of living, our health, how we will travel. I have to be honest with you. Those few classes that I took in science in college, I wish I paid more attention to. I also lobby for industry. I'm sure that makes me very popular here. But as I'm working, I find that, you know, there's a knee-jerk reaction we all have when we don't understand science. And it's really easy to say, oh my God, ammonia, oh my God, nitrogen oxide, oh, those are bad things. Yeah, but you know when you put the two of them together, you have nitrogen and oxygen, both benign products? But if you go out and you go out onto the street and say, hey, should we mix these two? What do you think? This company wants to do that. Oh, my God, no, we have to close that company down. Science is critical to our future. Let's really be careful what we're teaching our children. Let's make sure it's right. And if, in fact, they become right, I will run naked through Boulder and ask them for an apology. Thank you.
I thought we were going to have someone from the audience possibly articulate. I wanted to put that into play.
Yes, if you would like to go there, fine. But if you have comments, this is the time.
Okay, I'll just do one follow-up. I don't really disagree, and I don't think anyone disproved anything that I said in my overview. You'll notice I did not use the G word. I used the C word. So I'm going to read just a quote from Michael Shermer, who's the founder of Skeptic Magazine, Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown, 2005. It's a new book. And he's a harsh critic on intelligent design theories, and I agree with all of his criticisms that I've seen thus far. Michael goes on to say, if intelligent design is not a science, and I don't think we've really established that in this panel yet, then what is it? One of its originators, Philip Johnson, a law professor at UC Berkeley, wrote in 1999, quote, the objective is to convince people that Darwinism is inherently atheistic, which I would interpret as lacking a theory of consciousness with a small c. It's inherently atheistic, thus shifting the debate from creationism versus evolution to the existence of the G word, God, versus the non-existence of God. I see that as a progressive move. That gets the C word back into the debate. From there, just continuing the quote, from there, people are introduced to the truth of the Bible and then the question of sin and finally introduced to Jesus. I see that as regressive, and I see that as backward and something that I think we're in agreement with here. No one wants to teach that in our public schools, and it should not be taught in our public schools.
The fact is that Darwinism is not atheistic. It is simply not fundamentalist. It doesn't believe in the literal interpretation of fallible 500-year-old English translation of a highly questionable and shifting text.
Completely agree with that.
Even if you believe in Genesis, you have to deal with the fact that in the first two books of Genesis, it takes different periods of time for God to create the world. Genesis couldn't even make up its own mind on how long God took.
I'm not arguing for God in my case.
If Adam had to be lonely before God saw he was lonely and created Eve, then some time must have passed in between there, too. So that the fact is that mainstream Christianity has no problem at all with Darwinism. None. And what we're dealing with here is a political religious movement that has captured parts of the Republican Party with their belief that public policy has to be dependent upon and not in contradiction with their extremely limited fundamentalist religious views involving stem cell research, Terry Schiavo, abortion, abstinence versus birth control, and on and on and on and on. And it even comes back finally to predestination and the elect, which means we don't need Social Security and social programs because God will take care of those and they will prosper if you believe in Him.
Okay, one of the things that the panelists noted and asked me to request from the audience is if there is someone who is an articulate spokesperson for the creationist position, if you would like to take 5 minutes at one of the mics on the aisle.
If you have the bravery.
That's a tough room.
More questions.
That's why I said if you...
Older but bolder.
If you would like to come down to the mic.
In the absence of anybody else, I'll do it. But actually, I brought in a professor of chemistry who teaches here at CU, did his doctorate in at Caltech as a chemist. And I asked him to come in here to speak, and he listened for about 30 minutes, and he said, these guys do not know what they're talking about. They're not scientists. And Roger Ebert, what in the world is he talking about this like he knows what he's talking about? He said, I got research to do. He got up and walked out. So I'm a little sad you don't have any scientists, bona fide scientists who know what they're talking about, our philosophers of science that know what they're talking about this. You've got what looks like, from the creationist side, is propagandists. We're all Democrats. This has got to be a political movement from the right. And so there won't be any discussion from anybody to the other side to give their defense. It's just, they're just bad guys. So that's just not fair, is it?
So go ahead.
Well, I'm trained in philosophy, so I know a little philosophy. Go ahead. What?
Everything that I said was scientifically sound.
Yeah, but you're not a scientist.
That doesn't mean it.
Well, that makes a difference. It makes a difference in that you're trained. If you're going to... Okay, go ahead. Say what you want to say. Go ahead.
Did your friend give you an example of a scientific error that I made before he left?
No, I didn't want to talk. You know, I'd like to get him back. I'll call him on the phone.
Let me put it this way: there are a lot of smart people in this room. I would appreciate it if somebody here could tell me of something I said that was scientifically in error.
Well, I don't have a full record, but there are scientists that disagree.
And
with
I happen
you.
To be a Republican.
Carl Koval, who is the chemist, is a Democrat. So he's a Democrat that disagrees with you. Well, you're the one who brought it up. You're the one that called all the creationists right-wing Republicans. So you brought it up.
Okay.
So typically what happens. I still think at the end of the day.
Okay. We're going to open it to questions from the audience. If you would please come to the mic.
I do want to make one last point. There are scientists like Michael Behe, who's a biochemist, who disagrees with you. So bring him in and let him speak directly to you, Roger. And that's fair, except he actually knows what he's talking about.
Okay. Let's take question from this mic and then that mic.
To Roger or Daniel, either one, did the fundamentalist Christians actually take possession of the Republican Party, or was it the other way around? Because I believe we're fooling ourselves if we're Democrats or independents or whatever, if we think that the Republicans' party is being controlled by the by this small minority.
No, I believe there are a great many Republicans who are very concerned about what's going on. Senator John Warner, for example, made an interesting statement a week ago, and last week there was an op-ed page article in the New York Times by Bush's former ambassador to the United Nations concerned with the fact that Republican policy was being shaped by fundamentalism and that this was not the true heritage of conservatism in the Republican Party, and that it was being stolen away by faith-based politics.
As a Republican, let me state the following, and who works in Republican politics and who often deals with the very people you're speaking about. If you look at the big draws for the Republican Party now, they're the Giulianis, they're the Schwarzeneggers, Schwarzenegger, hence stem cell research. Yes, there are absolutely those elements within the Republican Party as well. The Republican Party is a party that's growing rapidly right now. Somebody turn down my mic just because I was saying positive things about the Republicans. What's going on here? Okay, the Republican Party is a party that is growing very rapidly at the moment. And yes, they are also, whenever you deal with a big tent, whenever you're dealing with a lot of people coming together, there are going to be some issues that you have to fight and balance out. But on that same token, you know, those people, as I can't remember which of the gentlemen said, when you're teaching evolution, you don't want to deal with the crowd, the people picketing outside. I don't remember who said that, but You know, remember, those people that pick it, you know, if you just look at the Schiavo case right now, the majority of Republicans disagreed with Congress and Bush on how that was handled. That's not true. Not true. That's not true. Bush never would have run the election with such a narrow base. Absolutely not true. So, and as a matter of fact, I advise you to come to the panel tomorrow, the end of traditional Republican, where you'll actually be able to, a friend of mine who's a pollster for the Republicans will be there. But, you know, when you're looking at that, as somebody who does work for the Republican Party, as somebody who's an ardent believer in evolution, it doesn't represent everybody in the Republican Party. It represents a very noisy wing of the party, but not the Republican Party.
The panel probably should have been entitled Intelligent Design versus Evolution, because since 1987, when the Supreme Court said that creationism could not be taught in the schools, they changed their title, but not their background and information. But anyway, the whole idea of intelligent design, I'm a scientist, by the way, a chemist. I'm sorry the other chemist left. But anyway, intelligent design has absolutely zero scientific evidence for it. Evolution is not just a theory. It is about 140 years of scientific factual information established in thousands of journals around the world by independent scientists, reproducible, and so on. But the question I want to ask you is this about intelligent design, because I have not been able to ask an intelligent design person this, but perhaps one of you have heard his answer to it, because I'd love to know it. Intelligent design requires an intelligent designer, and this intelligent designer has designed some of the most magnificent things, incredible things, like the universe, like human beings. So who designed the intelligent designer? Another even more magnificent intelligent designer? I think we're back to the turtles.
However, there is also the puzzle which Darwin was concerned about, and that is the wasp that paralyzes the grasshopper but keeps it alive and then buries its larva in its flesh so that the grasshopper can be conscious of being eaten alive but is paralyzed and powerless to resist. And it was hard to believe that this benevolent, intelligent designer would have not been having a very bad day when he thought that one up.
It strikes me as no small irony that intelligent design has a special appeal to those who don't seem to be all that intelligent. Einstein was, shortly before he died, was asked once if he believed in God, and he kind of boomed and ahed and didn't really want to come down. And then the interviewer said, "Well, don't you think that God is responsible for order?" And he said, "I think God is order. I think it's the ordering principle." And I think that's a very, you know, I'm personally an atheist, but you know, if I wasn't, I could certainly buy that argument. The question I had is, do you think this trick, intelligent design argument that's going on, is in a sense just sort of another development of an anti-intellectual movement that's existed in this country since its founding? I think it's important to bear in mind that this country was founded by religious zealots, that got kicked out of Europe because they were too extreme. And they came to this country and set up one of the most autocratic theologies or theocracies.
That's not true. That's not true. New York, which not only is my mother state, was the Dutch predominantly. The New York City, the engine, the economic engine of this country, was a primary design from the Dutch India Company. And if you look at, and I highly recommend, once again, I talked about David Landis' book, The Wealth and Poverty of Nations. You know, the Dutch were anything but religious fundamentalists in any way, shape, or form. They were merchants. That was, if I dare say so, their God. So I disagree with that. Not only that, but many of the other people that came here for seeking religious freedom, there certainly was that element. They also believed in freedom of religion and the separation of church and state. Okay? They did not want our state dictating any religion to anybody else, because God forbid if it's another religion and not mine. That's another whole issue.
Microphones, sir.
How do you what? Death, death, torture. How do you explain the Salem witchcraft trial?
We're gonna go with the mic.
Thank you. Thanks very much for an interesting panel. Evolutionary theory invokes the word theory, which in a popular consciousness implies a very high degree of uncertainty. And science, and some of us in this room are scientists, science involves a movement from total uncertainty toward certainty, but never to certainty. Science always retains uncertainty. A point along that continuum is theory. I wonder if any of you feel that, in fact, we are serving those who would posture faith as the equivalent of science if we are not helping them by retaining the word theory in association with evolution, when we have these now centuries of evidence in that are supporting our understanding of the evolutionary process.
What it takes is a group of scientists trained in the method to agree with it and declare it a law. That's really the process of science. It's a group of specialists, a very small group, 40, 60 people, highly trained, and their students. They're working on the research. They get together. At what point do we go from theory to a law?
Well,
it's absolutely universally true for all cases.
Sorry. Invoking the word law.
Science is more comfortable with theory, and religion is more comfortable with law.
Yeah. Invoking the word law, I think, brings in a red herring. Atomic theory is no longer talked about as a theory because we now have electron microscopes and other devices that enable us to see atoms. It's no longer a theory, but okay. Neither is it a law. Laws don't define everything we know with a reasonable degree of certainty.
It's a semantical thing. We have to be clear on our language on these issues. That's all.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Palmer is telling me that the next session is about to come into Mac. And if people could please exit the side doors, let's thank our panelists very much.
He's right there.
I think the guy, his fellow chemist.